this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And of course, as you know, we Zoom this interview the day before, so we're going to be chatting with our guests on Monday afternoon. But as we have done now for months, we begin with the powerful words of Colonel Vindman when he was testifying before the impeachment hearings in the fall of 2019. Every day I fear that not only is it not going to be okay for him and his brother, I fear it's not going to be okay for us and for the rest of the world, not only given the leadership of our current president, but given the devastation of this pandemic. We are living in very, very challenging times. But now the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right. I hope those words will be ringing in your ears in November of 2020. I think the other thing that should be ringing in your ears is remember Wisconsin. That goes to the pandemic. I am very lucky. Why am I lucky? Because I have found a website called theconversation.com. And I probably mine it more than any human being on the planet, because what I've come to value is that where a lot of reporters go and talk to professors and PhDs about their area of expertise, they then get to glean a couple of sentences. What The Conversation does is it actually goes to those professors and those PhDs and says, write the damn article. And that's exactly what they do. And just to let you know, I've pitched a couple of professors to theconversation.com and they've been writing damn articles too. But I am a child who always had this thing about farming. My two daughters have worked on organic farms. I lived in a little tiny town of Orford, New Hampshire. We had more cows than people. I don't think we had a stoplight, and I think we had one stop sign. And so whenever there's a story about agriculture, I tend to focus on it. But given what I'm hearing now, it was even more important. So before I introduce my two guests, let me read you the title of their piece, which so intrigued me and has now become the conversation across the board. In fact, on Monday, the day that we Zoomed this, I heard Governor Cuomo actually addressing this issue. But here it is. Why farmers are dumping milk down the drain and letting produce rot in fields. Joining us right now is Elizabeth Ransom. She is an associate professor of international affairs and senior research associate at Rock Ethics Institute at Pennsylvania State University, and Melody Dupuis, professor and chair of environmental studies and science at Pace University. Let me welcome Elizabeth and Melody to the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Did I pronounce the right last name, Elizabeth? Is it Ransom?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, let's start. So I'll start with you, Elizabeth, because you were number one on the list, and I'm going to begin with you anyway. There is such a shock here. We produce so much food in America. We have the food basket in the Midwest. We provide food for China, Cuba, around the world. We really see this relationship. I went to school in Minnesota, and my roommate's father was the vice president of Cargill. So I heard a lot about huge agribusiness. But as we're looking at what's happening as a result of this pandemic, there are a couple of interesting things that are occurring. One, we're noticing a tremendous amount of food insecurity, and people are now rushing to food banks where the lines go on sometimes for miles. And the food banks are overwhelmed and slammed in a way that they are not prepared for. And then we're reading stories about milk being dumped in ponds and euthanizing, you know, chickens and euthanizing pigs and lettuce rotting in fields. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, there are hungry people. There are farmers who have already produced or bought the livestock, and yet there's a disconnect. So Melanie, walk me backwards into what has occurred before this to explain why they can't get food to people? Or how are the markets different that whatever they're marketing to doesn't exist today?
Well, farmers, small, medium, and large, are really having a hard time finding an outlet for their production. And why is that? Well, for commodity farmers, really the problem is the concentration of the food system. There's no other outlet besides the large processor. And if the large processor is closed, there's nowhere for their food to go. And the food chain at this point in, it has become increasingly concentrated. And you see a lot of farmers nowadays saying, well, maybe one of the things that should come out of this is a re-regionalization of food processing so that farmers have more outlets to and more choices as to where they send their food. So what has happened is that this concentration and that there's fewer and fewer processors for farmers to provide to have an outlet for their produce production.
So Elizabeth, the other thing that I'm reading about, and this is also mentioned in your article, is that there are actually two sort of raison d'etre for producing food. One is for me at the grocery store. So I go to the grocery store and I buy my chopped meat and I buy my lettuce and whatever. But the other really huge consumer is schools, is restaurants, is sort of these large, more sort of industrial users of food. And what we know is virtually across the board, schools have been shut down. Some of them are still providing food. I love what's going on in the city of New York. And if you don't know, the city of New York is now providing anyone in New York City can go to a school and get 3 squares a day. I mean, it's unbelievable. It used to be just the students, then it was the students and their families. And then Mayor de Blasio said, I don't care. Just show up and we won't even ask. We'll provide you with food. But that's a rare situation. For the most part, what we're seeing is that restaurant use is completely trashed. And what we're seeing is a lot of the industrial schools or universities are not using it. So how do we understand that food chain? And is there a possibility of flipping from that assumption to a very different assumption in short order?
Great question. I think, and this is why in the article we insisted on talking about specific different products or commodities, because it looks different depending on what we're talking about. So I'm going to give you a concrete example.
Perfect.
Potatoes. You'd mentioned potatoes in our early correspondence. And so thanks to Melanie, we looked it up. And so 70% of all potatoes go into the restaurant, the industrial side. And it makes sense if you think about it, not a lot of Americans are at home frying potatoes to make French fries. And that's what the majority of potatoes get used for. And so that's a really tough one to solve because it's not just a matter of changing how many potatoes are going into one chain and putting it into the other. It's a matter of Americans don't use potatoes in the same way at their house. There are obviously other types of products like meat, which we mentioned in the article, that historically the institutional side, restaurants and universities, they take larger quantities. They might take different cuts. Those we are seeing pivot. We're seeing a slow shift to be able to utilize those products by repackaging them, or even in some states, restaurants are now allowed to sell them out of the restaurant to a household. But it's going to take a little bit more time. And again, households often don't consume the same types of meats at home that they do in the restaurant. Right. And so that's where we sort of had to talk about specific different products. And of course, Melanie has covered a lot of ground, but she's really, I would say, an expert on milk, although she may not proclaim that.
So I keep thinking milk. I want to toss to Melanie. So I'm thinking milk, and I'm thinking people go, oh, but after a couple of days, you know, it goes bad. Maybe you can use it for baking, but otherwise. But that's not what milk is used for. Milk is used in mozzarella. Milk is used in cheese. Milk is used in so many different ways. Yogurt. I mean, I can have yogurt in my refrigerator for 3 months, you know. I mean, don't tell anyone. But I'm looking at this going, so I get what is happening with milk, but isn't there a way for us to be able to take milk and make it into a product that has a shelf life? And the shelf life would be so useful right now. Is it that there just aren't enough pizzerias that are using the mozzarella, or is it that we don't have that capacity to make that kind of product because that's not how we've been set up to do?
Well, the whole milk marketing system, which is the most complicated economic system probably in the world. As people say, there's only three people really in the world who understand the milk marketing order system, and two of them are dead.
No.
And so but the basic aspect of that system is that you want to be able to pay farmers more money for fresh milk because fresh milk is perishable, you got to move it quickly, so on and so forth. And so they, in the 1930s, they created a system where farmers could make a living selling fresh milk, and then whatever was left would go to manufactured milk. But what's happened is that there's so much milk being produced nowadays that so much of it is going into, that so much goes into cheese. And even before the COVID-19 crisis, the cold storage for cheese was really very, very full. And so now you can't make cheese because there's nowhere to put it. And so the marketers, so their dairy the dairy marketers said, well, we'll, you know, have discovered pizza. And over the last decade, even, and over the last couple of decades, pizza consumption has just doubled. Okay. So, and so we've basically been putting our extra milk into pizzerias. And if the pizzerias aren't open, then there's it all gets stuck in the cold storage system and there's no more room. That is very similar to the situation that's going on with French fries and potatoes. There's 3 billion, pounds of potatoes in these cold storage systems. And if we don't get that moved out to French fries, when the new crop of potatoes comes out in July, we're not going to have anywhere to put it.
So you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of the fact that oil and gas has gone down to like a negative $2.
Yes.
And that whole, this is so freaking amazing how these stories are almost identical. And the reason why oil is, and I think it sort of bounced up a little bit, but the reason why it went into a negative number was because they didn't have any place to put it. So
we don't have anywhere to put it because nobody's using it. So the consumption of, we are based on an economy that's based on people consuming these commodities. And if they are not being consumed, the whole system falls apart.
But let me stop you there. So Elizabeth, I understand not driving, but people are still eating, okay? Mm-hmm. There's a difference. I'm not getting in my car, but trust me, I'm eating way too much, okay? I'm eating all the time. And that may be true with me, but then there are people who would like to eat all the time, but they can't afford food or they can't find food. And I wanna connect my overabundance with their underabundance. And I wanna look at all this food that's out there. So as I'm looking at this, Elizabeth, and I see the federal government saying, oh, we're gonna help the agribusiness. We're gonna give you $16 billion and we're gonna help the food banks with $3 billion. And I'm thinking, well, maybe there's gotta be something else that we can do. So as you folks have been sort of thinking about this in your orbit and your bubble, here's what I'm thinking. Okay, but restaurants have empty refrigerators. And food, it can be stored in schools and universities because they're empty too. And I am looking at how do we at least temporarily make a connection, but more importantly, how do we change public policy to encourage the idea of more regional growing and help to sort of begin to disentangle ourselves with these huge agribusinesses that control the entire market. But when they control the entire market, what we're finding out is big in this situation turns out to be lethal and bad, Elizabeth.
First of all, the sort of question mark in the middle, though, is money, right? Just because there might be space. And of course, it's questionable if there's space because a lot of restaurants are currently still sitting with their refrigerators or their freezers full, but they still have to cover their bills, right? And so the challenge there is, I think you still actually have a storage capacity problem. And of course, everyone who's in need of food now is largely in need because they don't have the money, because they've lost their jobs or they've been reduced in their wages. And so then the question is, how do we build a more resilient food system? And that's where we sort of ended our article by saying we do need to rebuild and think more creatively about smaller, more nimble food chains. And there's lots of ideas out there. There's definitely one in the milk sector because dairy was hurting long before COVID started. This has only accentuated the harm and the hurt that has already been happening. But in the case of things like meat, there's been an effort to rebuild local slaughtering and processing facilities. We've seen a massive decline. In the 1960s, late 60s, we had about 10,000 processing facilities. And today we only have 3,000. And of those, there's only a few that are actually mega processing. So this comes out of Purdue. An agricultural economist notes that 15 pork processing facilities in the US, all based in the Midwest, process 60% of all our pork. And so the moment you have any one of those go down, you begin to have this backup in the system. And of course, you have a lot of pork producers concentrated around these processing facilities. So we just recently read an article that all these pork producers are trying to get rid of their cows. I can't remember the population of Iowa, but let's put it this way. They have way more cows than they do people in Iowa. And so in short of people driving cross country to pick up a cow to take home with them, there's a real problem here of a bottleneck of the system and the concentration of having all pork production in a particular region of the U.S. along with all pork processing.
Oh, God, Melanie. So, you know, I keep thinking of this, and I go back to everything that I believe in. And everything I believe in, so I'm a big environmentalist, and I talk a lot about energy issues. And I talk about the democratization of energy. The idea that I would have my solar panels, and I would, you know, make sure my house is efficient, and I would become my own little power plant. Well, in a lot of ways, what we're talking about with food is we disconnected food from regions, from states. We ended up outsourcing, in a lot of ways, all our butcher. We had a guy on yesterday who talked about how almost every city and town had a couple of butcher shops. Mm-hmm. Can you name a butcher shop in your town? Can you find one? They don't exist anymore. That's a throwback to the past, but that was a past where the meat came to the butcher shop and the butcher shop came to your street and then you were able to access it. So do we have the capacity to say to agribusiness and this consolidation, Melanie, that in a time of crisis, and we may be going from one crisis to another because it's not just going to be pandemics, it's going to be climate change, that we need to rethink how we grow our food and how we grow our dairy? And because in a lot of ways it is growing these things. Can we do it? And is there a policy changes that should be recommended going into 2021? Because I think this is really a come to Jesus moment on so many issues, including what we've now learned from this consolidation from agribusiness that has now made us hungrier and more vulnerable. And we're seeing a kind of waste at a scale we can't even imagine now.
So it's really ironic that there's been a political movement in favor of relocalization when the most local commodity that we have had in the last 50 years has remained milk. And they even talk about milk as a milk shed, right? Which is sort of like a watershed. It's flowing down into the urban areas and so, but this has changed. Over the last 10 years, the consolidation in the milk industry has created a situation where large processors and large dairy farms are producing more and more of the milk and competing with the regional producers. We still have, milk is one of those rare situations where we still have regional milk producers. We have Cabot, which is part of the agri-market. We have small processors in the area. But they really are struggling because of this new concentration of these very large dairy farms that are turning up in the Midwest and outcompeting our regional farms. Now, meat is a little bit different because it's been a very long time since we've had a local meat system and whether or not we should be buying all our beef should be coming from upstate Vermont or upstate New York. Well, there certainly are producers here, and you can see, because I've been working with local farms around here and local consumer groups, and there are meat CSAs around here where people can go and buy local meat. But that meat is like $30 a pound.
I know. That's my whole problem. So much of what we're talking about. So as soon as I hear the word local, I go ka-ching.
Yeah.
Because the cost of the pound of beets, you know, the cost of it doubles or triples in price. One of the things I hear, Elizabeth, is that what they're trying to do with food stamps, for example, is to allow people who have food stamps to be able to use them, but those food stamps at a a food market versus a farmer's market, that at a farmer's market, that food stamp would have double the value. Because in order to buy that pound of beets, you need to have double the value in order to do that. But we have, I mean, there's Michael Pollan, who has a wonderful book called Food Rules, which I recommend everybody read it. But there's something wrong when you can spend more for a pound of beets than you can for a box of Twinkies. Because when you realize you put it in packaging and you've got to cook it, you've got to market it, and yet that's really where we have come to. So as I'm going from your article to the situation we're existing in now, I realize there are a lot of things that we may do to band-aid the situation, but band-aiding isn't a solution. Band-aiding is a redirecting based on a current problem, but I see the current problem being part of our future. And have you and Melanie and a number of other professors around the country started making sort of recommendations about what we can do so that we can actually have more locally sourced food? It'll be good for the environment. Frankly, one of the biggest fears I always had when we lost our dairy farms, Melanie, in New Hampshire, was that we would lose our landscape. You know, they weren't just a place where you got your milk. They created the most beautiful places on the planet because it was why you love living in New England. Have folks started, Elizabeth, saying it's time for us to rethink our relationship with agriculture, and that bailing out agribusiness may ultimately have created the situation that we're in today?
Absolutely. I'm going to actually have Melanie really speak to this because she's worked with a lot of different actors that are actively both academic and more what I describe as sort of activists in the food system. But the one sort of note I want to comment on, though, is you have to remember, though, the types of food we get through more industrial and longer supply chains. If you read in the literature, it's artificially cheap. It's not that it's that cheap to produce. There's economies of scale in everything we do, but we also have massive subsidies in the U.S. that target certain things like feed crops that go to feeding animals. And if you took those subsidies off, suddenly the feed would be more, which would drive up the price of more industrial produced meat. That's not to say that we're going to ever get to a point where maybe local is just as cheap as this more massive sort of mass scale. But it is to remind that we don't include a lot of things in the price tag that comes through the more sort of consolidated industrial chains. And now I'm going to give it to Melanie.
So Melanie, we only have a few minutes left. So tie a bow on this conversation. You know, we're watching the food being dumped. We're watching people at food banks online. We're watching kids not getting their 3 squares a day at their schools. So we know that there's a disconnect. We're the richest country in the world. But when you see how many people are food insecure, a pox on all of us not to have seen this before the pandemic, but the pandemic is just sort of exacerbating everything that we understand. So if Melanie could do something, what would Melanie do?
Well, number one is we should, we have antitrust rules, and those antitrust rules have been ignored over the last 50 years. So that's one place we need to go. Secondly, the farmers, the dairy farmers in particular, are asking for some sort of production controls. A number of dairy farmers. It's an argument that's going back and forth, and I understand that there are lots of issues around it, but I think we really, in this particular situation, we may want to do that for at least for the near future. And then we really do need to come up with ways to reconnect people with their food at the local level, even, you know, and some of that is going to be more expensive, but I think we need to figure out ways to bring people together to at that local level as well, to be able to have a food system. And why can't we have that food system? Well, in the 1920s, when food started to go, prices started to go high, people are advocated for higher wages. And higher wages, and instead we did not get higher wages, we got cheap food. If we could have wages
to
afford healthy food, then we could afford to pay farmers enough to provide us with that food.
Can I ask a question, Melanie? You're talking about your recommendations, but who do you make these recommendations to? In other words, who would make this happen? Are you talking to a whole lot of private farmers, some small, some huge? Well, are you talking to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or, you know, who's going to do this?
Antitrust has to happen at the federal level. I mean, we have a Justice Department that should do its job. That's one. You know, we, you know, the idea that cheap food is going to be the solution is something that's going to, it's going to stop being the solution really soon. And we are going to need people to be able to make a higher living. And I'm all for, you know, minimum wage and things, like that, so that people can afford to eat healthily. In terms of production control, that definitely has to be at the federal level.
Well, I'm thinking about all the agribusinesses in the Midwest, and I keep thinking about my mother being so emotional about the farm bill. Oh, we have to support the farm bill. And I'm going, Mom, you know what the farm bill is? It isn't some guy driving a farm mall. I hate to break it to you. You know, it's some guy sitting in a posh office in Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know, who's making nine figures, you know. And I said, and that's the problem. We have this illusion of agriculture. We have this image of farming, and it doesn't fit the reality of the moment. And I think this is such a powerful opportunity for us to re-educate the American people on how we process our food, how we get the food to market, why we're suddenly seeing them dumping this food, why we need to sort of almost reacquaint ourselves and reinvent the food system in America. Because in a way, that's part of our national security policy. You know, and what you're seeing now with all those food banks and people so food insecure, and we're not quite sure how long this is going to last until we find a vaccine, it really is a wonderful opportunity for voices like yours to help us figure out how to rewrite it. And it probably doesn't require only a Justice Department. It probably requires an administration that understands justice. So with that, Elizabeth and Melanie, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope in 2021, we can call you again and we can see who's writing the new legislation so that we can begin to change the situation that we exist. And I hope there's at least a quick fix for people who are hungry. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. You're welcome. We're going to go to a break. And when we come back, oh, guess what? We're talking oligarchy. Of course, this must be the attitude. See you in a bit.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Along a busy intersection in Tacoma Park, Maryland, cars pull into the parking lot of RS Automotive to refuel, but there's not a gas pump in sight.
We just replaced them with electric charging stations.
Matt Wade is CEO of the Electric Vehicle Institute, a Baltimore-based EV equipment supplier. In 2018, the company received a nearly $800,000 grant from the state of Maryland to expand new electric vehicle charging infrastructure. The Institute partnered with Tacoma Park gas station owner Dipeshwar Doli. They used some of the funds to convert Doli's station into an EV charging center. Doli also runs an auto repair service on the lot and has learned how to work on EVs and hybrids. So Wade says the conversion to electric was a natural fit. And he says that Doli is actually making more money now than he was before, because the profit margins on selling gas are often slim.
I think it's critical that people see this as a working reality. It works. It's not just a showpiece. It's not just a novelty.
Wade expects it to be the first of many gas stations to add EV chargers, either alongside their old gas pumps or in their place. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Living in a bubble, flying to the Bahamas in your corporate jets. Bubble, bubble, pop goes the bubble. Get into trouble, come a runner to the feds. The feds said them jets got to go. You Leland E.K. CEOs, Leland E.K. CEOs, Leland E.K. Long time ago, Leland E.K. Marie Antoinette said, Leland E.K. chopped off her head. Bubba, 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 blowing up a bubba, taking all the money, leave another for the rest. Bubba, bubba, off goes the bubble, and let the taxpayers pay off the debts. Can't pay because you let us all go, you let an EK CEO.
Welcome to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And again, I want to remind everyone, we Zoom on Monday, so you can hear it on Tuesday. So I went to BuzzFlash, and I saw this article, and I went, I haven't talked to Mark in forever. But the article is just incredible. It's both a history lesson, and it really sort of mirrors exactly what we are seeing right now. And only Mark Carlin can do this well. The title of his piece: Oligarchy Was Behind the Confederacy and Slavery, as the plutocracy today backs the infection-spreading white protesters. So let me welcome to the program Mark Carlin, editor of BuzzFlash. Thank you so much. And this history lesson was so valuable. And again, you know, I've said this over and over again, you know, history doesn't always repeat itself, but it sure as hell rhymes. And in this one, it almost feels it's not even rhyming, honey bun. I think it's almost repeating itself. So welcome to the program.
Thanks, Arnie. It's a pleasure to be on.
So let's talk a little bit. Let's go back to the South. Let's go back to the time of slavery. Let's go back to the Confederacy and re-educate, or maybe educate for the first time, my audience about really what were the facts on the ground. What would we be seeing if we were in the South right before the Civil War? Because I think we have this sort of gone with the wind image, and the reality is so different.
I think there are several key points. I think the first point that's very important as you make a parallel between the antebellum South and the US Republican oligarchy today is that only 7% of families in the South own slaves. That was an oligarchy. And then you had whites who were often very disgruntled because many of them were indentured servants. They were just above being slaves. And many others just managed to get by in poverty. They weren't treated well by the oligarchy, but the oligarchy needed them to accept the hierarchy. And the church was very important in this. The church, basically the ministers, bolstered the concept that the oligarchy was at the pinnacle. Then you had the struggling white class, including the indentured workers. And then you had the slaves. And to keep the non-slave owning whites from becoming too restive, you had to pin them against the slaves. You had to really get them to hate black people, regard them as subhuman and disposable. And this carries over now to the oligarchy we have that's financing these infection protests, which they really are, because many of these whites are openly congregating in front of state capitals without any social distancing. There are no wealthy people there, but the organizations, as the Washington Post wrote in an article last week, behind these so-called open up the economy protests, are the organizations run by the oligarchy in Michigan, where there was a very raucous crowd that assembled to oppose Governor Whitmer's lockdown. The DeVos family played a big role in that gathering through an organization that they fund, a very right-wing organization in Michigan. And then you have the Koch brothers, and I include a tweet from FreedomWorks, which brand
FreedomWorks, yes,
sponsorship.
Yes. Yep.
And the FreedomWorks was founded by the Koch brothers when both of them were still alive. And then you have the Mercer family, which is not known by many people, but the Mercers have played a very, very big role in Trump land and the modern right-wing organization, the Republican Party and right-wing think tanks. They had actually a role in getting Brexit passed, and then they brought that model that was used to pass Brexit over to Trump.
Right.
So I think there's a very, very strong relationship in parallel between the Confederacy and what we really have now, which is a neo-Confederacy. Yes, the South lost the Civil War, but the Republican Party, if you look at Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, and you look at Trump, and you look at all these oligarchs, they basically have adopted the model of the Southern slave states. And
You know, as I'm listening to you, Mark, it's almost unbelievable. So again, you mentioned that 7% of the families in the South owned slaves, and slaves were the sign of wealth. That was their wealth. Their wealth was not like, you know, right now owning stock in the stock market. Wealth was defined by the lives of the blacks that they controlled and owned and sold. And I look at that 7%, and then I look at the incredible grotesque inequality here. And I look at the, you know, the top 7%, or in this case, the top 1%, that basically own and control how much of the wealth of America. And, you know, it may not necessarily be in a body form, but it definitely is in a wealth form. But in a lot of ways, what you're seeing right now with the pandemic is that Donald Trump's base, we keep saying that it's a cult following. We keep talking about Jim Jones, and I keep thinking they drink the Kool-Aid. Well, let me just remind you, anyone who drank the Kool-Aid died. So what's so fascinating to me about Donald Trump, it's not only that blacks are expendable, and there's a wonderful story from the Washington Post, I believe it was even today, where they were looking at what's going on in Georgia, and the Washington Post headline was, "For black folks, it's like a setup. Are you trying to kill us?" Well, what is so remarkable, Mark, is that those protesters are going to be dead, and those protesters are going to be the conduit to expand and, you know, the COVID-19 throughout the population. And then it's going to be the frontline workers, as these black folks said in Washington Post, you know, that it's a setup to kill them. And they don't even realize that they're just a pawn in this game. They're just a pawn. They're being used. But you go back to the South, as you point out in your piece, that's exactly what the rich white slave owners wanted. They wanted resentment between the black, the slave, and the indentured servant, the white. Both were screwed, but one had to be convinced that they were a little less screwed than those on the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. And the key point that was consistent with the South is that these whites who weren't part of the oligarchy were regarded by the oligarchy with suspicion and fear.
Yeah.
And they were expendable in the South, and they're expendable now. You don't see any of these wealthy oligarchs who are, through their organizations, instigating these protests. But they're sending, they know, these oligarchs know that the coronavirus can infect anyone. And they aren't going out there, but they're sending these disposable and expendable white followers out there to become infected. They're basically saying they're expendable. And the underlying motivation here, as so much is in the Trump era, is race. Now, that doesn't come out. They haven't really been, as a group of protesters, bringing up the racial issue a lot. But it's a big, big factor. They won't be out there.
Yeah.
Assuming that they're immune from being infected and completely ignoring
all the public health guidelines. I mean, they're not
all the public health guidelines, and they wouldn't be out there if they didn't think that this was a Black urban disease and a disease of the elderly. And
but you mentioned in your piece, you talk about how important the church was, and that the church kind of, you know, reinforced the pecking order. It reinforced all these things. And I keep thinking about the large churches, the evangelical churches, where they're insisting upon people meeting no matter what, with the idea that social distancing, or someone carrying a sign that said, "Jesus is my vaccine." You know, I mean, I'm looking at this, and it's horrific to me that not only is it the manipulation by wealth, and the manipulation by the oligarchs or the plutocrats or whatever it is, but it's that the church now is being used as a handmaiden for this ultimate horrific consequence. And that's the part that I don't quite understand. And I guess maybe my question to you is, Mark, is there any way to make those expendable whites understand they're in the same boat as the people they think they hate and the people they think they distrust? Or is it just an impossible bridge
this has been a problem in our society. It's the major social divide, racism and racial underpinnings to so much of the way that the wealthy get poor whites to back them. Look at Trump's followers. It's resentment against Blacks. The South, Andrew Cuomo brought this up the other day, and I've written several commentaries about this. Most of the states who receive more back from the federal government than what they pay in income taxes are in the South. Mississippi is number one. And Kentucky, Andrew Cuomo pointed out that Mitch McConnell should not be talking about not assisting blue states and keeping from going to bankrupt because of the coronavirus, because Kentucky is a big, big state that receives much more federal money than it pays into the federal treasury. So basically, Kentucky is a moocher state, you can say.
But you know what's so fascinating to me, and you know, having run for governor, I remember at one point in time, I was getting accosted by a group of conservative men. And they were talking about the fact that, you know, the federal government, we send so much money to the federal government, we get so little back, yada, yada, yada. And then one of the examples they were using was, and Medicaid is a great template for this, because if you are a affluent state, then the federal government probably matches you 50 cents on the dollar. So you put up 50 cents and they're gonna put up 50 cents. And this is your way of providing healthcare to poor people. But if you live in a poor state, Mississippi, Kentucky, you name it, Louisiana, it turns out that the federal government cuts a bigger check. You only have to come up with 10% of the Medicaid dollars or 20% of the Medicaid dollars, and the federal government will pay 80%. And all my voters in New Hampshire were so ticked off that it was a 50-50 match. And look at those Mississippi, where it was 80-10 or 90-10 or whatever. And I kind of reminded them, I said, you know why you're at 50-50? Because you're freaking rich. Because you're the seventh richest state in the nation. Because we have some of the smallest poor populations in the country. I can let you be Mississippi, but then guess what happens? Au revoir to your wealth, increase the level of poverty, and you too can be Mississippi. You know, and again, we don't teach people, Mark, anything. We don't understand policy. We don't understand taxes. We don't understand why Mississippi gets more and why we get less. We get less because we happen to be successful, which is not such a bad thing, you know? But then you've got the Mitch McConnells that, you know, during a pandemic, want to throw people like, you know, the state of New York under the bus, as if New York hasn't historically been the foundation for so much investment in all the 50 states. And again, he's playing that, interestingly enough, the blue card, red card. Maybe he's playing the race card. Maybe, you know, who knows what he's playing, but it sounds so effective, and it's so sad that Andrew Cuomo, during the time of a pandemic, has to teach public policy that we have historically been even afraid to teach. And I refer to Democrats, Mark, who've been afraid to teach that. I mean, I was the first Democratic candidate that ever explained to them, we were freaking rich, and that's why we didn't get more back. You know, and that didn't mean that I didn't want to have the federal government invest in my state, but it also recognized what the federal government was supposed to do, which is to look at us as a country, not as little individual fiefdoms with hands out.
I've done commentaries. There's a couple points that are appropriate to what you just said, Arnie. There's some statistic, and I don't have it at the tip of my tongue, but Mitch Romney, when he ran in 2012, won like 194 of the 202 poorest counties in the United States. That's not an exact figure, but it's something like that. And they're white counties, they're rural counties. And you say, well, why would they be voting for Mitt Romney, who considers people on government programs in his infamous tape that he didn't know he was being taped, that 47% were moochers? It's because they resent the Democrats giving money to blacks, that they think they deserve it, but blacks don't. And so that's one point. Then there was a congressman, I believe he's retired now, and I wrote this commentary about 2012, from Kentucky, as a matter of fact. He had as one of his biggest ongoing platforms as a congressman, he had been in Congress many years, was dramatically reducing food stamps, and then also Medicare and Social Security. But the district he represented that voted for him, I think with 72% of the vote in the year I wrote this commentary, was 76% of the residents received either food stamps, Social Security, or Medicare.
But Mark, so I understand voter suppression. I mean, I understand that part of the problem is you don't want the people that would vote you out to actually have access to the voting booth. I get that. But you know what? When do we do a campaign? And the campaign is this, and I've been saying this for a long time, Mark. And the campaign is do the math. Do the math. And if you just do a campaign on do the math, what you were just describing in Kentucky with that congressman, where 76% of his district was on food stamps and welfare, I would just go into every single damn household of every single voter and say, okay, sweetheart, let's do the math. Your congressman is about to screw you. Okay, and let me do the math for you, because this is what, if he gets to do what he is saying in this campaign, this is how you get hurt. We're not talking about a black, we're not talking about a Hispanic, we're talking about freaking you. I mean, everything in a way is, Calvin Coolidge had a great line. And the reason why I love Calvin Coolidge's great line is that he said this. He said, patriotism means looking after me by looking after my country. And what was brilliant, Mark, about that conversation, that quote from Calvin Coolidge, was he started with the selfish piece. Because it wasn't about looking after us. It was about looking after me. And by recognizing that we tend to be sort of selfish animals, at least initially out of the box, by then being able to say, okay, but if I look after my country, then maybe me does better. And I'm just trying to figure out, how do we have the me conversation and then explain why the all of us doing better helps you?
The answer is you're being entirely rational, and this is a rational issue. This is an issue which Trump plays very well, of playing to so-called grievance politics among whites who need someone to blame. And as in the South today, the basic issue is, are those grievance whites going to blame the oligarchy, or are they going to blame the blacks the immigrants coming through the infamous wall, and the oligarchy is manipulating them, the Americans for Prosperity, Freedom Works, all the other groups out there, to, along with Fox News and the One America News Network, to channel their grievance against the poor blacks, poor browns, immigrants, any foreigners really, except if they're from Europe. And
that's right. Norwegians. Those Norwegians that Donald Trump loves. He wants to invite all those Scandinavians to come to America. In part, I think he has this thing for blondes and blue eyes, but if nothing else, you're absolutely right. It's the Europeans that he wants.
And I think that they do a very good job in these protests. You know, you're looking, the coronavirus has opened up these fault lines that have been pre-existing in American society.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And they are, the oligarchy is very successful, as they were in the South, of diverting white anger from the lower middle class or middle class to minorities, and they're the unspoken group in these protests, but that's what these protests are really about.
So Mark, before I let you go, I gotta ask, is there, you know, out of every tragedy, there is an opportunity. And the pandemic has, you know, ripped off the scab of so many things that people like Mark Carlin and Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes have been talking about for decades. And sometimes, you know, you feel like, as someone described me, that I'm like that motto from Dartmouth, a voice in the wilderness. Well, I feel like here's the good news. Now it's a chorus in the wilderness. I mean, it's not just a couple of lonely voices, but that there is becoming a growing chorus of voices. And so the pandemic, in an interesting way, also provides us with opportunity. And I see some of the things that happen as we need to sort of obviously have a change in administration, no question about it. Joe Biden, who I always say leads from behind, needs to follow a more progressive agenda and needs to sort of take on the wealth of the 1%, because they don't represent an economy. They just represent an ability to basically sort of suck the economy dry. But I have to ask, and this is going to sound totally ridiculous, but I think we need to figure out places where people come together on an equal plane. And what do I mean by that? You're gonna be shocked. I believe in universal service. I believe that either all of us go or none of us go, whether it's the draft, whether it's universal service. But I always remember my dad, saying how much he learned from his time in the military. But what he learned from the bunk above him with the kid from South Dakota. What he learned was the bunk next to him with the kid from Louisiana, and that there was this change. It can't happen on Facebook. It doesn't happen in social media. It happens because we have to live together, eat together, work together, and be forced to be resilient together. And is that even plausible as we look at the future? I don't think it's just policy. I think it's bringing people together in a way where they have to sort of be shoulder to shoulder. And we have now been more and more isolated. And especially after the pandemic, which is like forced isolation, I think we even need this as an opportunity to sort of figure out how can we, through a policy, reconnect.
I hate to be a downer, Arnie, but on the other side, as these protests are, you know, representation of, Trump and his cohorts are also seeing the pandemic, the chaos of the pandemic, as an opportunity. And he's pushing through all sorts of pernicious policies. And I think he's also trying to find ways that he can profit from the pandemic. And there are many of his oligarchical, plutocratic colleagues who are indeed profiting from death, basically.
Oh, God. No, and look, I understand that. But I guess I'm just trying to figure out, And I'm going to go back to the wonderful line by Elizabeth Warren, that personnel is policy. So as soon as you get to change an administration, you get to change not the policy initially, but you get to change the personnel. And that means a different form of vigilance. That means a different kind of prosecutorial discretion. That means a different emphasis. And that changes things, even if the freaking Senate stays Republican, because you are able to change a significant amount of personnel and bring so many different voices and different visions in, that the incredible damage that Donald Trump has done, and maybe the incredible amount of affluence that a pocket full of, you know, billionaires are going to be able to make, I think there may also be a counter argument. And maybe, Mark, I got to believe that. I just have to believe it. Because if I believe that he wins even after he loses, then I lose hope. And I guess I'm not going to allow you to let me do that.
I hope too, but I also, you know, try to analyze on the ground what is happening. And I'm sure you've seen there are many things ranging from rollback of pollution regulations.
Oh, I know. I see them all.
To increasing car mileage, even though the dealers don't, the car manufacturers don't want it. And Trump is seeing the pandemic in his own sociopathic way as an opportunity to accomplish many goals, getting rid of inspector generals.
So you know what, Mark, I'm going to let you go, but let me just remind you, the damage he did in 3.5 years. So that means the damage he did can also be undone. Voting matters. Leaders matter. Leaders matter, everyone. I just want people to know that. And I need to say goodbye to Mark Carlin. He is the editor at BuzzFlash. The title of his piece, Oligarchy Was Behind the Confederacy and Slavery, as the plutocracy today backs the infection-spreading white protesters. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Thanks, Arnie. So,
this is
thanks
my passion and yours. All right, take care, Mark Carlin.
Yes.
Ciao. Thank bye-bye. You. All right, we'll talk tomorrow. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
Woman will say